Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm now joined by Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe.
And Alex Stewart.
Morning, Joe.
Hello to both and all. Today, we're talking about a couple of different things. Part one, dependencies, football dependencies. Oh, they're exciting. Also, how they affect teams in different ways. So we're going to be talking about Virgil van Dijk, other players including Kevin De Bruyne, Bruno Fernandes, Harry Kane, any fullback you seem to have written here. I don't know what that means, but we'll come to find that later in part one. And there's a part two as well to today's conversation where Seb spoke to the wonderful Jonathan Harding. Really like Jonathan. What did you talk to Jonathan Harding about, Seb?
All sorts. We did a little bit on Hertha Berlin and the big old mess that's happening there. Very, very strange situation. We also chat a little bit about Thomas Tuchel because he is inbound at Chelsea. So we wanted to just get a little bit of background there.
Yeah, danke. Yeah?
Bitte.
Thank you. Very exciting. Spass. Very exciting, isn't it? I wonder if Chelsea will be developing a dependency on him.
Ooh, nice.
The police are coming to get me. Anyway, before we can start today's episode, let me just remind you that if you haven't already subscribed to The Athletic, then you have managed to listen to, I would say, we're into triple figures now of adverts of me telling you to do so. And I'll hope today's advert is the one that will convince you. I'm going to say some things now. Here they come. Here they come. It's good thing. It's good thing for £1 per week. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you get good thing £1 per week in your mind whenever you want from your mobile device. Yeah, you get good thing, good writers on the thing, and everybody's happy. Yeah, I feel like that's going to convince the people that haven't been convinced already. That's theathletic.com/TIFO. But for now, let's go to part one and talk about footballing dependencies. I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Alex Stewart and Seb Stafford-Bloor. Okay, footballing dependencies and how they affect teams. So these do hinge around specific players. However, we're going to have broad discussions around them. And the first one will be Virgil van Dijk. Alex, I'm going to come to you for this because whilst we know a lot has been spoken about Virgil van Dijk, lots has been written about him too. The sort of butterfly effect is something that you're working on at the moment for a TIFO video. It's very interesting, isn't it? And obviously he's a huge omission.
Yeah, and butterfly effect's a good term for it because there's this kind of knock-on thing. So football teams are what we call a complex system. That means that every part is interdependent and related, and it becomes very difficult really to assess the value of one part in exclusion of the others. So what each player does is related to what all the other players do and how they work together as a whole. And so if you remove one part of that, even if the whole of the rest of the team stays the same, then the knock-on effects are quite significant. Obviously, with Liverpool, there's an added problem, which is because they've also had injuries to Gomez and Matip. It's not the same otherwise as well. So you've had players moving into different positions. And what we can see from that example is, straightforwardly, Liverpool are not able to do quite a lot of things as well as they did do with Van Dijk. And we can talk about those things a little bit in a minute, but also I think there's another point to make, which is familiarity as well. That if you have a team like Liverpool that is based on a core of 13 or 14 players who are very used to playing with each other and are used to one another's roles and functions within that team, removing a couple of elements of that or jigging a couple of elements around, as well as the tactical side changing, it also just means that team is less comfortable. it's less well-oiled, it's less well-drilled in everything that it has to do. So you can really see the effect of taking one crucial player out of a side. It can massively alter the complexion of how that side plays.
I think this podcast is a complex system. Hey? Yeah.
One other thing I think it's a little bit overlooked, and it's a product of where Liverpool are at the moment, but you do wonder whether in a situation where Liverpool are struggling to create chances and not scoring as many goals as they need to, particularly in tight games where they're facing stubborn opponents, one of like the big misses with Van Dijk is just his threat from set pieces. At the moment, they've scored 6 times from set pieces this season, so corners and free kicks, and that kind of places him in the middle of the Premier League pack. Add Van Dijk to that, particularly against a team like, I don't know, Burnley, for instance, or that game against Manchester United in the FA Cup, and you just have a kind of, not quite get out of jail free card, but a player who can help you when you're not playing well, get you a goal when things aren't working as well as they might do, when players are jaded, attacking systems aren't quite as well-oiled as they usually are. And I think that's vaguely true with a lot of centre-halves. Like, it's rare to find a centre-half who isn't proficient in the penalty box, in the attacking penalty box. And it's just, if you look back, actually, like, all the way back to Blackburn Rovers when they won the Premier League title, there are a couple of games towards the end of that season where they didn't play particularly well, and then they get a goal from someone like Colin Hendry, for instance. And it's one of those sort of underlooked, overlooked aspects of a centre-half's worth. Obviously, like, you need the security and you need the kind of defensive exits and you need the stability for fullbacks and defensive midfielders and goalkeepers. But actually, they're a big attacking weapon most of the time.
I completely forgot that Colin Hendry existed.
With his big broken nose and his bleached hair.
He was quite terrifying, wasn't he? I think it was the mixture. It was the hair. Like, on top of it, it looked like it was the wrong hair. But
he's also was he not the player who ended up on his arse during the famous Paul Gascoigne?
Was indeed.
Euro 96 goal. Yeah.
Yeah.
That must have stung. Yeah, Virgil van Dijk scored 5 goals last season when Liverpool won the title, which is a sizable return. I don't know whether those goals were in clutch games or to, you know, to secure a win or something, but that's, you know, a good return from a centre back, and he got 4 goals and 2 assists the season before, so it's an important contribution.
Well, also, even if the centre half isn't scoring himself, like, most centre halves are a key part of any set piece strategy. Like, if it's a near post run, if it's misdirection, like, if he's got a little bit of a, you know, like, a screening role around the penalty spot to prevent markers from getting to where they should be, like, it can cause all sorts of havoc, and it demands a major rethink in that department.
And set pieces are kind of a small version of the overall issue, aren't they? Because a player is assigned those roles, they're training in, you know, 5, 10, 15 different set piece approaches, and learning that role and having somebody else take it and having the other players know that that player's going to do it and they're trying to remember what it all is, it's a sort of a good mini example of how this issue affects teams more broadly.
So I watched the second of the Liverpool-Man United games the other day. Still don't think it was as good as the first one, Alex. But one thing that kept...
I kept won that back.
Don't rake over the old...
60-odd percent agreed with me.
Yeah, well, 60% of people are wrong. That's the problem. You know, that often happens, doesn't it? I mean, listen, Donald Trump was voted in. What I'm saying is I watched the game. I saw the pundits describing the effect, I think, of no Van Dijk, and also discussing, you know, Henderson and Fabinho being dropped back into the centre-back roles. What that exposed in the midfield. There's been some discussion about Thiago also, which I'd be interested to get both of your takes on, even though it's slightly tangentially related. But also, one of the reasons that I think Manchester United seem to have so much height and so much width in the game most recently was because there was no Henderson in midfield. Of course, he wasn't playing at centre-back either, although he was for the first game. But the point I'm making is that, you know, you lose a big player in the centre-back. You have players dragged out of their natural positions. Henderson is the player in the central midfield area for Liverpool that would normally tuck in behind those full-backs, prevent those opposition-wide players making the deep and long runs. And that just really wasn't happening against Manchester United in the second game. So suddenly, you know, Liverpool start to concede chances and opposition opportunities that really, I suppose, are much more rare in normal games. It's an area of the pitch that is just more often than not locked off. And that seems something that's sort of, tactically speaking, three or four steps removed from Van Dijk not being there, but he's still indirectly affected by his absence, Alex.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think particularly when you look at a team like Liverpool, where, you know, obviously there's a complex pressing system, but also the fullbacks are pushing up as high as they are. And we talked a lot before, and it's interesting that, you know, a lot of the conversation around Liverpool's tactics a couple of years ago was the fact that this was a midfield whose job was to cover, was to move into other parts of the pitch to allow the fullbacks to push up, that it wasn't a creative midfield particularly. And that's what you now see missing. And they are trying to compensate by injecting more creativity into that midfield. So players like Thiago, obviously, but also Jordan Shaqiri coming in. But there's not necessarily... I don't know whether it's that there's less familiarity, those players are less defensively minded. But Liverpool they were sort of trying to change that approach slightly before Van Dijk got injured, but still with the security of Henderson being able to be that cover, particularly for Alexander-Arnold on the right-hand side. Not just a cover either, you know, the way that Henderson pushes up into the right half space to act as a pass inside and slightly back option to allow Liverpool to recycle. Yeah. That's been lost. But I also think from a defensive perspective, one of the things that Van Dijk allows Liverpool to do as a really good and quick one-on-one defender is to play a higher line. And this is something that I remember that we saw with Manchester City when Fabinho was being forced to play at centre-back. Instead of having a proactive forwards defensive line, if that makes sense, having a player who's not a comfortable centre-back means that the defence quite often are retreating instead, that they're seeking to regain their position closer to the goal, prevent longer shooting opportunities, and that allows space in front of the midfield. And of course, with Liverpool, there's then a knock-on effect, which is that they can't press as high, they can't control space in quite the same way, they can't then get those counter-pressing opportunities that they used to thrive off. So, you know, we can see these kind of reverberations out from the absence of one player, exactly like you said, in terms of how the fullbacks push up and the midfield cover, but also in lots and lots of other different ways. It's a, like I say, it's a complex thing.
Hey, Seb, Liverpool's player Thiago is rubbish, isn't he? He's really rubbish. And Liverpool haven't ever won a game since he's arrived. He's awful. And he's actually, I think, he was behind the Brexit vote.
Yeah, the internet really went hard on him, didn't they? It's funny because I think one of the other things I'd say about Liverpool's midfield is because there's been so much flux and changeover, I wonder when they come up against a team who transition a lot, who have midfielders who move from midfield into attack, which is most teams in the top half now, in the Premier League at least. I wonder how difficult that is, because obviously within that you're passing over marking responsibilities and defensive obligations. And all of a sudden, when you start removing pieces like Henderson, I mean, in my opinion, probably one of the loudest players in the Premier League, like especially now, like you can really hear how verbal he is on the pitch and how much organising he does.
Almost as loud as Andy Robertson.
Right. Almost. That was really weird. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
That was
screaming
weird
at a player to try and put him off. Although, do you remember when it was a couple of years ago, Arsenal were playing against that team who had the goalkeeper who ate a pie at halftime. Do you remember that?
Sutton United.
There was a moment in that game where Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, still at Arsenal at the time, was running down the touchline, and the fullback he was facing tried to put him off by pretending to headbutt him. Do you remember that?
No, I'm sure not specifically.
Okay, so Google that and see if you can find it. It's very, very funny. But I wonder for
last
someone
time
like
I
Thiago,
used Google, I found out some horrible stuff about Colin Hendry, so I don't want to do it again.
Let's not go down that path again, I guess. But I wonder for Thiago, obviously he's used to a system and he prospers in a system where there's a lot of possession and he plays, sorry for the cliche, but more of a quarterbacking role. He has the armchair from where he, you know, picks his passes and, you know, cuts lines, changes the point of the attack. And now he's not in a situation where that's little bit up in the air. It's not quite as controlled as it used to be, but also you have all this sort of vague confusion in that department because of the flux. I think it's really, really difficult. I can't get on board with any opinion which begins with no, Thiago is not a really, really, really good footballer, because I don't think that's a sustainable position, really.
I think it's funny because I think, you know, naturally you would assume that if you replaced one of the three, fairly workmanlike Liverpool midfield of last season with either a player like Thiago or a player who offers more in terms of attacking verticality, that they'd be a more attacking team. And it doesn't really work like that, does it? Because it's a complex system, according to Alex or someone else. Anyway, that'll do for the Reds. Let's get on to the Blues. And that is, of course, Kevin De Bruyne, who is out for around 6 weeks. Poor fella. He's a good footballer. He'll want to be playing football. And, of course, Pep Guardiola will be disappointed to lose him because he's the best player that they have. Alex?
Well, he's
I care about this one.
Yeah, no, I can tell. He is, I don't know if he's the best player they have, obviously, I can't answer that, but what? I can, well...
Sorry? You don't know that Kevin De Bruyne is Manchester City's best player? Now I care.
Well, I think it's very difficult to describe a player as best or not,
Are you doing a joke?
No, I was going to say he's their most important player. I mean, okay, he probably is their best player, but I'm...
Thank you.
You know, he's got 10 assists so far this season in the league. Nobody else has got more than three. He's also got 3 goals. And what's happened with the way that City are setting up is that he has very often been the primary creative focus, almost to the extent that nobody else is expected to do anything. And so City have kind of had to adapt because of these midfield problems that they've had with Gundogan and Rodri, and De Bruyne has been playing off the striker, but with the athleticism to sort of do some covering as well. If you take him out, all of a sudden, it's probably worse for City in that regard than losing Van Dijk is for Liverpool, because you might have less system adaptation, but everything's been going through De Bruyne this season. Pretty much everything, and that's just it's a much more straightforward loss in terms of playing quality to understand. It's not as complex as the Van Dijk system thing, but it's probably more impactful.
I think that was the case for most of the season, wasn't it? And then over the last sort of, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 games, Seb, we started to see some material contributions from elsewhere. I'm thinking of the number of goals that Gundogan scored, for example. But I mean, there's just no replacing Kevin De Bruyne, is there? And I imagine, as Alex says, perhaps there isn't a system change required. It's more of a personnel change here, or a change of lineup, for example. But psychologically, this probably affects the team a lot.
Yeah, I think also probably affects the way that the little tendencies that players have within games. Like Kevin De Bruyne isn't a one-trick pony by any means. He's as complete a footballer as there is in the league, obviously, but I wonder whether
he's the best one at that club.
I'm with you there. He's
thanks,
I think, yeah, good player. But I was looking back over sort of some of his better moments from this season earlier this morning, and obviously one of the balls that he really likes is that right-footed arcing ball from a kind of shallow right position,
curves at the end, the half space cross.
Yeah, well, and then I was thinking, if you're a forward or a wide forward in that situation, then you tailor a run around his ability to play that ball, because there are very few players in the league or the world who can play it as accurately as and reliably as he can. And then if you're missing De Bruyne and you're trying to replace him with someone like a Phil Foden or a Bernardo Silva, for instance, if you're a forward in that system, none of those players can replicate that sort of that shape of pass And so as a result, you then start to have, you need to make different runs to exploit defensive weaknesses instead of, for instance, instead of running off a defender's outside shoulder on the left half of the pitch, you're having to go inside because a left-footed player can't play that pass. So it's really interesting. You can go quite micro with the detail there, but forgetting the fact that he's just a very, very good player who can unpick any defence that he plays against. Like, you're essentially creating a situation where players have to relearn their habits for about 6 weeks. It's really
weird. That's quite interesting, isn't it? Yeah. Teammates will train themselves to do stuff on the basis of a player who can do things that no one else can.
Well, yeah, because
those moves are irrelevant or useless if he's not there.
Yeah, we're doing a little bit of work on Dennis Bergkamp at the moment, and there are a lot of interviews which I've either listened to or read where players talk about knowing what kind of passes he can play before he even receives the ball, and so making the runs into the right positions to capitalise on that. Now, okay, Bergkamp and De Bruyne are obviously different eras as well, different skill sets, but it's the same principle. You take that away, all of a sudden, you know, instead of seeing the ball go to De Bruyne and making a run, you know, 5 seconds before a defence has an opportunity to react to it, or a split second before, I should say, all of a sudden you have to pause and think. It's like, no, that's Phil Foden on the ball. He's probably going to carry it a little bit, and then, you know, he might dump off over 10 yards rather than trying to play something over 25 yards. Bernardo is a little bit like that too. I mean, maybe I need to move here because he's left-footed, and so even if he's playing on the outside of the boot, it's not going to bend into my path in quite the same way. And you know, in a Premier League game where the margins are so fine, that makes a difference.
Tell you what, Dennis Bergkamp and Kevin De Bruyne, it might be different players, but they've got the same hair, haven't they? And this reminds me of this theory I've been working on for a while about hair and football teams, because I think you'll agree that if you look at Premier League football teams, the best player in each team has a particular haircut, and at least sort of three of the other players who are sort of that player's friends, or maybe the younger players, they have the same haircut.
Expand.
And each Premier League team has its own kind of haircut. So, for example, I used to think this about Southampton. Everybody who played for Southampton about 4 years ago all looked like they were going to, you know, the 1947 RAF ball reunion or something. And they had that kind of swept hair with the side parting. It was all very tidy. It was kind of light brown or blonde. And there was some, you know, consistency to it. And of course, James Ward-Prowse had this haircut. And I think, you know, some of the players were basically
Callum Chambers had
following
that haircut
him
for a while.
Callum Chambers had it too
before he moved to Arsenal. Yeah,
Arsenal had something very similar. Arsenal had the shortened trims. You could say, for example, a really good example is Leeds. There are about three players there who have the same kind of unusual haircut.
In soconomics, there's a thing about scouting and some of the issues that
Zinchenko and De Bruyne. Sorry, that was my other example. Go ahead.
With scouting and the blonde players tend to stand out more in scouting reports, really? Because if you're watching a whole team, then your eye is more naturally drawn to lighter colours. And so blonde players get scouted better because they get paid more attention to.
Huh. That's interesting.
It's bizarre.
Like that.
Yeah.
But I think there's something about these hair chemistry, you know, they just conform to one another. And you know, I think Zinchenko's choice of hair is a subconscious support and adulation of Kevin De Bruyne.
David Luiz and Matteo Guendouzi, when they played together for Arsenal.
Yeah, although I think they both had that hair separately prior to joining each other, so we can't say
I think
that
they
that
did.
Has been, yeah,
but
that
I,
hasn't
but
been.
But I did feel there was a connection there, and also
I think there was a connection.
I would sometimes get the two of them confused from a distance.
I suppose, though, with that, you have to really commit to that hairstyle. Like, you can't just go home one day and think, I fancy a change, and the next day.
How
you've
long
got
has
this massive...
David Luiz had that hair for?
For long a time. Long time. You can find some very early pictures
of him
without
it, though, didn't
at Benfica.
He cut it and then it grew back. I mean, I disagree with you, Seb. I think the, you know, what literally happens is that you don't have to commit to it, that it just grows. You just choose not to do anything, or you act in
absence
of choice.
It's the opposite of choice.
Yeah,
no,
it's non-commitment.
I disagree.
And that's what happens
to...
when you don't commit to anything.
No, I think you have to maintain that haircut. I mean, if it's to look if it's to grow to a Premier League standard, then you do need to oil it. You probably need to re-perm every now and again.
Have you ever had shoulder length hair?
When I was very young, yeah.
Okay, well, me too, and I never oiled mine. But I'll tell you,
you have very
straight
hair. There's this.
I don't have very straight. I have very thick hair. I looked like a you know, I looked like a tree.
Twat.
Or something. Wow.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Bruno Fernandes. We saw an example over the weekend, of course, the Liverpool game, where Donny van der Beek was let out for once. Nice to see some quotes from Donny van der Beek over the weekend, stories suggesting that he's happy to wait and be patient and, you know, hey, fair, if that's true, fair dues, because he didn't really have much of a sniff in this game. I sort of felt like rudely tweeting at 15 minutes, is Donny van der Beek playing? Because I hadn't really noticed him. Not that it was his fault. It was locked down in the centre of a tense game. But he came off at about, I don't know, 65 minutes and was replaced, of course, by Bruno Fernandes, who's barely missed a minute since he arrived last January and I think has scored more Premier League goals in that time than anybody else. He's, you know, undroppable, except for the fact that he was kind of just dropped for a bit. He joked after the game about not needing a rest. He wasn't tired. And you sort of think United are an entirely different outfit without him, despite the fact that, of course, In recent, you know, games, Paul Pogba has stepped up to the plate too. Stepped up so far that Jermaine Genius made him man of the match for that game against Liverpool, which was slightly odd. Maybe Manchester United managed fairly well without him. And of course, he came on to score this lovely free kick, the winning goal. Seb, begin. Bruno Fernandes, he's 28, isn't he? What have they got left of him?
He's 26.
He's 26?
Yeah.
Hot dog. Well, ignore everything I said. Let's move on.
He looks older.
Well, he does look a little bit older. He's got a little bit of a weathered look at the moment. But then that might be because he's been running to the ground.
No, he was weathered when he arrived. They got him like that.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
They've not broken him.
No, I don't want any... There's no issues with the deposit.
He's... I suppose what we've learned through lockdown and lockdown football and the nature of the fixture list is that players' soft tissues in their muscles are screaming with every game. And you do wonder whether there is something like that in Bruno Fernandes' future. But it's really interesting because if you... we talked earlier about kind of defensive mechanics and midfield mechanics. And if you take him out of the Man United side, you lose someone that... doesn't quite roam because you tend to see him in a variety of positions, but all in the same area of the pitch. So he likes the left hand touchline. He also likes to go beyond the last defenders, and he has a kind of, if you imagine like sort of a smooth, slight, almost right angled curve from the left hand halfway line up to about the penalty spot. I suppose that's kind of his territory on the left of that. And if you take him out of that midfield, then you're left with players who can progress the ball and, you know, who can lead transitions and who can carry the ball, someone like Pogba. Van der Beek can do some of the things that Bruno Fernandes can do, but you lose a lot of the variety. Forget the skill set. You lose a lot of the, I suppose, the surprise element in the Man United's midfield. Because I think part of the success is yes, he's an excellent player with lots of, you know, brilliant technique. But he's also someone that does things that will surprise you. So, for instance, if you remember, I think it was against Leicester. Do you remember the assist he gave for, I forget who scored the goal. It might have been Marcus Rashford, when he was kind of falling and he just prodded it into, he prodded it into the path of the centre forward scored
goal.
Like that kind of, like, that's the kind of thing that you don't associate with him. But it's the little moments which you can't really legislate for if you're a defender, that he's able to contribute. And I think that's one of the things.
It's like he has more time to think than you do.
It really does, yes.
Well, you know, I think he's pretty good. Disagree with you, Sev. Don't know what you're talking about. Alex, when you take this player out of this side, what do they become? Because at the moment we're discussing, not seriously, I don't think, Manchester United as a team that could potentially win the title. The title. This season, and of course, you know, injury to Kevin De Bruyne, probably pretty good, but I don't think so. You take Fernandes out of it, and suddenly they are.
Well, they're 11 goals and 7 assists light. I mean, he's done a lot more than anybody else.
Right. Yes. That. Thanks for saving that.
And you know, Rashford is the next most productive player all round. And Rashford specifically benefits from having Fernandes on the pitch. So you don't just lose what Fernandes brings, you lose what he brings to United's next most productive player. I think as well with Fernandes, I absolutely agree with everything that Seb has said. That ability to conjure the unexpected, the set piece delivery, which is obviously very important. But also, I think it's hard, and this point was made during the commentary of the cup game against Liverpool, where I thought Jermaine Jenas was a very good co-commentator. There probably hasn't been a transfer into Manchester United that has had the same level of impact since potentially Eric Cantona. And so you're not just taking away a really good player who's done an awful lot. You're also taking away the player who has come in and pretty much single-handedly transformed United's style of play, but also their degree of success.
Can I make another suggestion quickly for a player who might have been more influential, impactful?
Go on.
Van der Sar.
I was going to suggest Dwight York.
Sure, that's also a good suggestion.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that I necessarily agree or otherwise, but I think it's, you know, this is somebody who's come in, who's won the player of the month X number of times, who's contributed a huge amount, who is being talked about as a transformational signing already.
Best signing of 2020 by 100 million miles.
Oh, without question. And so, you know, you with Manchester United, you kind of worry that there's a, I don't want to say that there's an issue with their mentality, but I think that the deficit in certain of the tactical aspects of their play, particularly in attack, means that they come to rely very heavily on Fernandes's ability to do unexpected things. And that's partly why he's thrived in that system. I mean, it's a system that's pretty much built around him in that 4-2-3-1. So if you get rid of that, you've also probably got other players looking at it going, well, how's, you know, if you're Rashford, you're thinking, well, how's the ball going to come to me in quite the same sort of way? It's similar to what Seb was talking about with De Bruyne. The knock-on effects psychologically, I think, can be quite significant as well. So, yeah, United can ill afford to lose him.
No, okay. Although, you know, to be fair to the team, they seem to play okay against a fairly stolid Liverpool side for 65 minutes without him, but I doubt
I thought Liverpool probably looked better up until Fernandes came on than they've looked in their last sort of 4 or 5 Premier League games.
In periods, right? I mean, so for the first 15-20 minutes of the game, they were totally on top. But I think for the end of the first half and for, you know, actually fairly long periods of the beginning of the second half, other than Liverpool's second goal, Man United were, you know, I felt pretty regularly throughout the game that Manchester United were more likely to win the game.
Yeah, well, we said this before the match.
But I felt like maybe those two sides went into that game with a slightly different mentality. It was very loose as a game of football, and it was as if they kind of, you know, it was a day off, let's have a crack at each other kind of game.
Yeah, particularly in comparison to the
league game. Yeah,
I think it's worth mentioning how good Luke Shaw has been recently as well. After we made that Man United fullbacks video.
Is Man United dependent on him? Is he a dependency now?
Well, I mean, Telles is waiting in the wings, right? But I think Shaw is just in a vein of form where people are being reminded of why a lot was paid for him as a very young player from Southampton. And
I like what a bastard he is on the pitch. I mean that, I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but I feel like he's very consistent when a ball goes out of the touchline and he's been chasing with an opponent to get there. He'll just give them a little push to make sure that they go into the, you know, not well, into the
Manchester
the
United
boards,
are
but.
Manchester United are not a team that has that edge particularly otherwise. I think McTominay is a little bit like that.
Fernandes is a bit like that.
Fernandes in a kind of more spiteful, slightly petulant way possibly. But I think good teams have always got somebody who can be a bit of a shithead, you know.
I find it really funny. Like it's quite fun to watch even the psychology of it, because you think like he's doing this for the benefit of his team. He's happy to Luke Shaw, the reason I like him as a player is because the way that he acts makes me think that he doesn't give a shit what anyone on the opposition team thinks of him. And that's quite endearing in a football player, because sometimes you watch games and you think, you know when pundits complain that the opposition players are talking too much? I should say pundits. You know when Roy Keane complains that players are talking to the other team too much and they're being too friendly? I don't think it's specifically that they're talking to each other or that they are friendly that is the problem. I think it's more that they aren't displaying, you know, what Roy Keane did, what Luke Shaw does, which is a total and utter contempt for the opposition just for that 90-minute period. That they don't give a shit about you, they don't care what you think, they only want to hurt you, they'll do anything to defend their teammates, even if their teammates are clearly, blatantly wrong, they'll still defend them, and they'll look like a tit doing it. Like that, I think that's what Roy Keane wants to see.
Yeah, Kieran Tierney does it a lot for Arsenal as well. And
Andy Robertson
really,
too.
Like, I really think it's like it's they're left-back shithouses. But I think that sort of thing is really important. I think if you're...
Does the shithouse cover it? I mean, we're kind of describing this sociopaths, really.
No. it's not that bad. I think it's not wholly performative, obviously. But I think teams need to have at least one player who's got that edge to them of unpleasantness on the pitch.
Just you think about playing against them, like what difference
really
that makes.
Important.
If you know that every time you reach a ball that reaches the byline before Luke Shaw, he's going to push you in the back. That kind of sucks, man. Like over 90 minutes, that's going to get into your psyche. Not only is it going to fuck you off if you're the wrong sort of character, if you're going to be reactionary to that, it's also going to change the way that you tense. It's going to change your body language. It's probably going to change the way that you move. Like, it's going to change the way that you not react to him, but the way that you are proactive about playing against
him. Well, your anticipation every time a pass is played in or that you're chasing a ball. What you want to do as a defender is make sure that the opponent is concentrating more on you and what you're going to do than they can concentrate on controlling the ball and then playing a pass with it. And this is part of how you do it. You make yourself incredibly awkward. And that I think that's a real quality in defenders.
Yeah. Shithouses. Anyway, that's probably the end of the part one. I think we've run out of time here. But we do have a very exciting part two coming up, where Seb spoke to Jonathan Harding, the wonderful Jonathan Harding. So do stick around and listen to that, and we'll be back at the end just to say goodbye.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Okay, welcome back, friend of the podcast, Jonathan Harding. How are you?
Very well, Seb. Thank you. Have me on.
Okay, lockdown hasn't been treating Hertha Berlin well. For those who...
Safe to say.
Yeah, I feel like we need to add a little bit of context here because without going to making this a very, very long segment, we need to kind of describe the dysfunction that's been going on. So if we start at the point where they had a fantastic new takeover and became extremely wealthy very quickly and started spending money like it was going out of fashion, what happened next? And let's begin with our old friend, Jürgen Klinsmann.
I think when you have an idea, you know, Hertha Berlin wanted to be this big club. You know, they called themselves this idea of this big city club that they've been branding about. And this has really been around Hertha's sort of quirky mottos have been around for a while. You know, like we try, we fail, we win. I think the club has tried everything they can to improve their image, and then getting Klinsmann felt like the last piece of the puzzle in terms of high profile, going to make a difference to the direction of the club. We've got players, we've spent money, as you say. And I think the lesson here is that throwing money and big names at a situation without having a plan is not going to get you where you want to go. And, you know, Hertha have insisted that they've always had a plan, or, you know, this is part of the process. But it's quite obvious that it isn't, and that the plan can't really exist if you've gone from one coach and four coaches later you've come back around to the same coach. You know, you get Klinsmann in after failing with Ante Kovac, who's a youth coach who came in after long-standing Paul Dardai was there. You know, you bring in Alexander Nuri in the interim, then Labbadia comes in, and then you go back to Dardai. You know, it's not a sign of a club that knows really what it's doing. And I think if you spend a lot of money and you appoint someone like Klinsmann and you don't think about the impact, appropriate nature of the appointment, does it fit? Does it make sense? Then you're only going to fall on your face. And that's basically what happened with the Klinsmann appointment.
Klinsmann seemed to expect that he would be given a kind of a full autonomy to redesign like almost all of the footballing departments within the club, and then from the outside, and please do correct me if I'm wrong, he repeated a trick we've seen before, which was, you know, to announce his resignation essentially via Facebook, which is unorthodox, I suppose, and then for yes. want of a better word, to kind of flounce off a little bit. I have a lot of lasting affection for Jürgen Klinsmann because of my own club loyalties, but how did they not see that coming given his past record?
Yeah, I mean, that again points to not making the right decision in terms of appointing a coach. You know, you have to have done your homework, and the appointment of Klinsmann suggested that they didn't do that homework in the right areas. I think the defense, as it always is in this situation, will be, well, we appointed a big name and it didn't work out, but we made the right decision for the club because more people are going to tune into a Jürgen Klinsmann Hertha Berlin team than otherwise. You could argue that they did get a large amount of publicity during Jürgen Klinsmann's 76 days in charge. But whether that was the right amount of publicity is, of course, questionable. I think him going on Facebook and coming out and, you know, saying that even, you know, Michael Preetz, the general manager, should also be fired immediately. Those are the kind of things that just show you how frustrated and disrespected he felt, but also how poorly the communication was internally. Because if someone is hired under the premise that they could potentially have more responsibility than then ensues, that's going to cause frustrations, especially for someone like Jürgen Klinsmann, who probably, you know, inevitably has a certain degree of ego about his ability to do the job. But it was the start of it wasn't even the start. It was just the next walking nightmare for Hertha Berlin, really, who have just never really got it right. And of course, the irony and the worst part of all of this, and you know, you've done some great work at TIFO about the other team in Berlin, who have proved that by not throwing money at the situation, but by actually getting smart people in the business and getting the right people in the building, you can be way more effective.
You mentioned Bruno Labbadia earlier, and he's kind of, I'm trying to draw a parallel, he's a little bit of a journeyman in Bundesliga circles. He's kind of, I don't want to tag anybody with the Sam Allardyce brush, but like he fills a similar kind of void. He's been around kind of everywhere. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think he's, I mean, yeah. I mean, maybe the Allardyce brush is a tricky
one. It's a harsh brush.
It is. It's definitely a little bit more than just a varnish that we're applying there. I think I think it's a tough one for Labbadia because, yeah, you're right. You know, I think Hertha was his 10th Bundesliga club. He's certainly been around. But he has done some good work at certain places. You know, he did do well at Wolfsburg. He has had it hard at certain clubs. I feel a little bit sorry for him on the one hand because I think he walked into a situation that he wasn't fully aware of. But on the other, if you watched Hertha play football in recent weeks, some of the responsibility has to fall at his feet because I actually think this squad is very talented and they shouldn't be near a relegation battle. And some of that has to be on him.
So he's gone and Michael Preetz, you mentioned the sporting director, he's gone with him. So as we're talking now, what is the shape of Hertha? What are the sporting dimensions, I suppose, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, it's not a positive one. I mean, you know, you've got Arne Friedrich, who's supposed to take over from Michael Preetz until the end of the season. And Friedrich had come in on this sort of performance coach sort of angle to begin with. I think the break from Preetz is a really interesting one. This is a guy who's basically been connected to Hertha for 25 years. I think that's monumental. I think it's also long overdue. I think he probably survived a couple of managerial sackings that he should have probably paid the price for. So I think this is definitely a fresh start for Hertha, except in that they appointed Pal Dardai, who's the guy who was at the start of this process, who had been in charge for 4 years until the summer of 2019, when this sort of revamped Hertha began. And I think that's my main concern. You know, in the four coaches that you've gone through since Dardai, you haven't really progressed. So why did you get rid of him in the first place? You know, let's not forget that Dardai took Hertha to the Europa League. Okay, they didn't perform that well, but he had them performing extremely well in the Bundesliga. And I think...
Did he get them promoted originally? Like back
No, that was Jos Luhukay who got them lifted in 2015. I think you've got the situation where Dardai's done such a great job in the past. And I just wonder... How can you justify bringing the guy back? I mean, it's interesting. Obviously, he's come in to try and steady the ship, I guess is the right way to phrase it. But yeah, I don't know about Hertha. It's a tricky one. I think this squad, as I said earlier, is capable of performing much better than it is at the moment. I don't know whether Pal Dardai is the right guy to do that, but I can understand the reasons for appointing him in the first place. It's a tricky time to be a Hertha Berlin fan.
Yeah, because it's a talented squad. I mean, beyond, like, I know Arsenal fans will be aware that Matteo Guendouzi is there, but Piontek, Nicholas Stark is there, Luca Bacchio is there, Cunha, who's a really nice
Mateusz,
player, isn't
Matheus Cunha is also
really good player. John Cadobra, I think he scored quite a lot of goals in Bundesliga 2.
Yeah, and Alexander Schwolo, the goalkeeper that picked up from Freiburg.
This is a good group of players that just, yeah, it's... It's strange. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Let's move on to another good group of players and another ship which needs steadying. Thomas Tuchel has... we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon, and he is en route to become the new Chelsea manager. I think one of the common common reactions to this has been, okay, there's been a lot of political fallout between Frank Lampard and Chelsea. There was, there was some tension there. And in response to that tension, they've appointed Tuchel. That doesn't add up an awful lot. Because describe to me why that's a logical response. Because obviously this goes back to not just the way he left PSG and the interview he gave, which kind of sealed his fate, but also his falling out with the hierarchy at Dortmund. For those who aren't aware, do you want to just run us quickly through the shape of that?
It's such an interesting appointment. I think you're right. You could write a thesis about this appointment, especially off the back of the Lampard situation. I think Tuchel never really vibed, shall we say, with Hans-Joachim Watzke, the CEO of Borussia Dortmund. I think Dortmund as a whole is a very specific case. You always need to, when you talk about coaches at Dortmund after Jurgen Klopp, you need to talk about him, even though part of the problem with appointing a coach after Jurgen Klopp is that you inevitably have to refer to him. Now, I remember when Tuchel was appointed, I think one of the headlines I read on Kicker, which is probably Germany's biggest football magazine, was the anti-Klopp. And so that, you know, Dortmund went in a completely different direction. He didn't really get on with Watzke, I think. I think he struggled with the concept that Dortmund were trying to challenge and yet at the same time were losing players, key players. I think this idea of being a club that develops talent but doesn't retain them for those pivotal years, I think frustrated him. He obviously had public clashes with Sven Mislintat, who, you know, then went on to Arsenal by the time was Dortmund's scout because he wanted to, you know, have a greater say in terms of recruitment. You know, he's clashed with players before as well. So he is a very intense and difficult character, I think, at times. But at the same time, you can sort of understand some of the arguments, especially in terms of challenging for trophies and selling your best players, for example. I think Watzke struggled with him because it came off the back of Klopp. I think, you know, Watzke and Klopp are friends, basically. And I think Tuchel was always going to struggle in that regard because he is very meticulous. You know, one of his nicknames is always this idea of like being a football professor. You know, that's one of his nicknames. And I think that is absolutely the antithesis of what came before. And I think at a club like Dortmund, you know, where the passion is something that is a desired trait to be on show, shall we say. I think that was hard for him. And I think that's part of the reason why he came under such criticism. Although I will say in his defense, you know, he's often accused of being very cold. I will say in his defense, when Borussia Dortmund were attacked on their way to a Champions League game in April of 2017, he was very supportive of his players. And he was furious that his side had to play a day later. So I think there is a part of Thomas Tuchel that is not as appears from the outside.
Is that just another Klopp thing in the sense that, you know, you're cold in comparison to Jurgen Klopp, which is, you know, a charge you could probably level at pretty much every coach in Europe at the moment?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, you know, I think the truth is the people who know him know him to be a warm person. And I've spoken to people who know him and who say that he is empathetic and he's warm. He's honest. You know, I think there's a lot there that we don't see. And I think the perspective of him being a professor and only analytical is a reflection of how he approaches the game. I think he's very intense. I think he wants to get all of the details right, but I think he cares deeply about the development of his players. I mean, Christian Pulisic became a superstar under him at Dortmund and ironically, you know, now reunites with him. He did wonders for Ousmane Dembele's career. I think, you know, he didn't get it all right with some players, but I think when he did, it was absolutely astronomical in terms of the development. So I think there is an inevitable, comparison to be made with Klopp that's going to make it worse off for him. And as you say, most coaches in Europe. But I think it's really important to be clear that Tuchel is not that. So I think Chelsea fans are expecting, oh, another German coach, does he have the same passions? No. And it's important to stress that Klopp is actually very... not very German in that respect. His passion is is unique to him. But I think what you do get with Tuchel is a guy who's learned the job. And I'm not sure you can say that for the outgoing manager.
I think over in England, I think a lot of people understand the differences between them as men. I think the big question is, from a talent pool perspective, you mentioned Pulisic and you mentioned Dembele, and that's good examples. I'd chuck Aubameyang in there and Mkhitaryan as well. These players that like played some of the best football of their careers under him. I think the question becomes, okay, he's going to go in and he's going to inherit this really decadent squad full of attacking players. Perhaps needs a, you know, rebalancing touch further back towards the defence, maybe. But I think, you know, the expectation is at Chelsea, you're going to be an employee. You know, you're going into a space which has been vacated by Frank Lampard, and it's designed in that way for a reason. It's because, you know, Chelsea's direction as a sporting entity has been defined by Marina Granovskaya, also now increasingly by Petr Cech, who's apparently growing in influence. That's the bit that troubles me. Like whenever you insert a big personality and a reputation, and let's be fair, a bit of an ego, into that kind of shape, you just think, yeah, that's going to cause some pressure somewhere. Do you think he'll? What do you think of that balance? Do you think that's going to work?
I think there's an inevitable amount of friction that's going to come from the appointment. But I think what's going to be telling is what Tuchel has learned from his time at PSG, because, and at Dortmund to a certain extent. But, you know, there's definite evidence there to suggest he's had to deal with some of the biggest players in the game at PSG and their egos and how to get the best out of them. And let's not forget, you know, he took them to a Champions League final, albeit in a very unusual circumstances. But, you know, they played a decent game against Bayern, and if Neymar and Mbappe get their shooting boots on in that game, it's a different outcome, and maybe we view Thomas Tuchel differently. And, you know, that's part of the perception problem in football, that success will define what kind of assessment is given to you as a coach. I think if Chelsea are smart, on the one hand, they'll let him have enough of a say to keep him happy and not try to put him into a box and say, you're only in charge of this. I think on the other hand, Tuchel has to be smart as well and say, right, there are lots of people who are already here who are working on different areas of the club. If I'm able to have maximum influence on how we play football and actually develop a style of play, because I think that's obviously been one of the criticisms of Chelsea in recent weeks and months, is that the plan isn't obvious. Whereas I think Thomas Tuchel's incredibly aggressive, attacking type of football that we've seen him play, if he's able to develop that, then, you know, he should probably be able to make peace with the fact that he's got enough of an influence there to develop a type of football that's great to see. But you're right. I think it's going to be very interesting. I think both sides have to mature in response to their context. You know, Chelsea have to be mature enough to admit that the appointment of Lampard was a mistake and that they're trying to move forward in the right direction now by appointing someone who's qualified to do the job and who knows what kind of football he wants to play and is capable of managing a squad with such big names. And on the other hand, Thomas Tuchel has to say, right, this is a huge opportunity for me. He's always wanted to coach in England. I can say that, you know, when he was coaching at Mainz, I had the fortune of chatting to him after a game when they got absolutely hammered by Bayern Munich. And even then, years ago, he talked about his admiration for England. So I think he has an opportunity here. And I think if he recognises that there is going to be some power struggle to be had, but if he plays it smart, then he can be successful. I think that's something I'd like to see from him.
Well, that was a nice conversation, wasn't it? What a nice man, Seb. And what a lovely anecdote he told you at the end.
Well, possibly. It's Tuesday morning. We haven't recorded it yet, but Jonathan is pretty good for a good anecdote. So, yeah, you know,
I'd say just make sure now I've said this that he does tell you one at the end of your recording. Okay.
Well, I will. I mean, we might have to construct one, and it may or may not be true, but we will try.
Fine with me. I'll look forward to hearing about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Alex Stewart.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thanks to you also, Seb, and to Jonathan Harding, of course.
Yes. Thank you, Joe Devine.
And of course, to producer Adonis. Oh, and before we go, one more thing. I'm just going to repeat that in the next couple of weeks, I think, I'm hoping as of next week, but I'm not sure entirely yet. You'll find out. Our Thursday release is going to become a Friday release. And the exciting thing about that for us listeners is that we can start recording just the day before it goes out. So if we want to talk about games that have happened, it doesn't mean that we have to record them and then the episodes are released sort of 4 or 5 days later. After a long period has transpired, other things may have occurred. No longer Tifo will be up to date, present, on the node. What do they say? Happening. Happening now. Always happening.
Finger on the exciting. Pulse. Yes.
Finger on the pulse. Yeah. Toe in the dam. And, you know, bum in the bath.
Sounds something very different. Like it's
toe in the dam?
I mean, we're not going to start averting disasters. I mean, we just, you know, yeah, finger in the dam. I mean,
this how
big are you
to
have your finger in the dam or your toe in the dam?
Like, Joe could just use his hair.
What, in the dam?
Yeah, just to kind of mat it across the gap.
I have got a lot of hair. But anyway, my hair will be here on a Friday and a Tuesday instead of a Thursday and a Tuesday. And I hope that will make a difference to your lives. Oh, and one more thing as well. I was thinking, you guys, you know how people's listeners or viewers have nicknames based on the thing they like? You know, like fan people, you know? So there was like the... I don't know any of the names, but you know what I'm talking about? There's a cultural thing where the people who enjoy something collectively name their group as, in relation to the thing that they enjoy.
They have a collective noun for their fan base.
Right. Yeah. That's what
don't
I'm trying
do this.
To say.
Don't. I'm begging you not to do this. Wherever you're going, stop.
I was thinking, right. we could get the listeners to start calling themselves this thing, and I've placed the perfect thing. It's perfect. I've spent a long time thinking about it. It's perfect because it combines two words, TIFO and podcast, and it sounds like TIFO, yeah? But it's TIPO. What if they were TIPOs, and we could address them as TIPOs, and they call themselves TIPOs, and in the future we could monetize it? You know, we could make a lot of money. So I'm just seeing if it'll work. I just want to see if people like the word TIPOs. Yeah. So
you
if you
fucking
like
lost it,
it
you are you
no
cracked.
No. Shush up. hey, come now. What I want to know is, listen, Seb's been lonely this last week because no one's had anything to tweet at him. But if you like the word TIPO, you should let Seb know on Twitter and just say yes or no. You're interested. You're not. Maybe suggest some other ones, and he'll come back to us next week and let us know what the results of that have been. Because I love a bit of audience participation here, particularly from the TIPOs. So anyway, thanks to everyone. And we'll be back on Tuesday. Au revoir!